This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this program in the past, we've talked about adoptees' search for their birth parents. Then the story of Nadia Suleiman, the so-called octomom, made us think about similar impulses among the children of egg and sperm donors. By tradition, the identity of those donors remains anonymous, but each is assigned a unique number, and that, plus the internet, allows children from different mothers who share the same donor dad to get in touch with one another, to find out more about who they are by meeting, for the first time, relatives from the other side of the family. And there may be dozens of half-sisters or brothers out there. A new study in the Journal of Human Reproduction reports as many as 55 children from one donor father. If this is your story, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. There's also a conversation underway at our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, how bad can it get? We begin a new series of conversations today. Economist Jeffrey Sachs. But first, the search for donor siblings and donor dads. We begin in Denver, Colorado, with Susan Hollander. She found her son Sam's half-sister Nicole through an internet site called the Donor Sibling Registry. And as a therapist, she also counsels donor families. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And what was it like when you and your son first met his half-sister?
It was different. We had been emailing probably almost a year, and we had shared pictures. So we were both excited, I think, and also cautious because these were strangers. But Sam and Nicole share the same genetic background. And so it was exciting, and I was feeling pretty cautious. Sam was just thinking, oh, this is cool. He thought it was very great. And I would say within a few hours, everybody relaxed. And after talking and looking for commonalities, it was amazing how much we just liked being with each other.
What was the impulse? Was it curiosity? Was it that reaching out for family that so many people have?
You mean the impulse to connect with them?
Yeah.
I asked Sam at the time if he wanted me to put his name on the registry because I feel like that's his decision, not mine. And he said, yeah, he thought it would be cool. He was 12 at the time, 12 or 13, and that he had always known that there were could be bunches of people out there who were his half-siblings, and he'd love to meet them.
Are there any others, to your knowledge?
There's one more. There's a boy who lives in California, and we have not met. We've emailed, but we haven't met. So those are the three of us have connected all through the donor sibling registry.
And you stay in touch?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Nicole and her mom, I feel like they're part of our family, and I know they feel the same way, too.
Part of your family. This is obviously an unusual way to acquire family.
It is. It is. So I think that this kind of forces people to redefine what is family. And in my mind, family used to be people who you share genes with and people that you grew up with. And that's why I went into this feeling kind of skeptical, because we had the shared genes, but we didn't know them. But there was such a bond when I saw Sam and Nicole together. They look like brother and sister. They have very many personality characteristics that are similar. They just fell into this easygoing, kind of fun sibling relationship. They skipped, of course, the fighting and stuff like that that younger sibs do.
Well, with any luck, that'll come later. Yeah.
Yeah, really. But they just love being together. And they email, and they Facebook, and they do all that stuff that teenagers do. She's a freshman in college. And it's just a really wonderful connection.
And if the third sibling, half-sibling, was willing, would you accept him or her too?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Again, with caution. Don't do this quickly.
Well, that's me. That's part of how I operate, but absolutely, if they wanted to make contact, we would.
Susan Hollander, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
Susan Hollander with us by phone from her home in Denver. She does counseling for donor families and found her son's half-sister on the donor sibling registry. And joining us now from Boulder, Colorado, is Wendy Kramer. She founded the Donor Sibling Registry in 2000, along with her son, Ryan. And Wendy, nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And she's with us from the studios of member station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. So how did you decide to start this?
Well, I had always had a very curious child, and at some point, we found out inadvertently that he did indeed have half-brothers and sisters out there. And his thoughts were, well, I might not ever get to know my sperm donor, but if I could meet these half-siblings, I could see that invisible side of me, that side that I don't know what it is, I could see this in someone else, and we would share that together. And he had always been so curious that when we found out there were half-siblings, that's when we posted our message on the internet to see, well, maybe other people are just as curious as he is.
And it ballooned from there, but it depends on each of those donors having that unique identification number.
Not always. I'd say for the most part, yes, because when sperm banks came into being in the late 1980s, that's when the donor numbering system started. So the people that were born after the late 1980s, they have an easier time connecting because they just look for each other on our website under the sperm bank and then the donor number. We do have a lot of donor-conceived people that are born in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s as well, before donor numbers were given, when it was done in a doctor's office, kind of hush-hush on the lowdown. And these people do have the opportunity to connect on our website also. If they have enough in common, they can put in for a DNA test and see if they are related. And we've had several people match this way.
And we're talking about children of sperm donors. Of late, there have been more and more egg donors, too, but I think this is, well, hugely sperm donors we're talking about.
At this point, it's mostly sperm donors. I think the egg donation business is kind of lagging behind as far as realizing the need for openness and honesty and full disclosure and a child's right to know their genetic and ancestral background. The egg donation agencies or industry is still kind of like where sperm donation was a few decades ago, very, very secretive and anonymous, and I think we have a lot of work to do there.
Well, much more complicated procedure, too. But nevertheless, as you look at this procedure, this is all by consent. People go to the registry. They're not contacted unless they wish to be?
Absolutely. It's mutual consent only. So we're not outing anyone. We're not invading anyone's privacy. For the donors, and we have more than 900 egg and sperm donors on our website, for the donors, they only come if they're willing to be found. And willing to be found can mean anything from just sharing updated medical information, which a lot of people find extremely important because the sperm banks don't do this. So they can share medical information, they can share photos, and they can jump on a plane and go meet each other if that's what they both want.
And there are some cautions here. These things don't always turn out to be storybook endings.
I would say mostly they do. On rare occasions, some people jump into this without thinking it through. So they jump in, they make a connection, and then they back away. And that can be hard for the other family who's totally willing to make a connection and expand their family. So we counsel people to take it really slow, be aware of the other family's needs and hesitations. Just go as slow as you need to go. Maybe first start with internet contact, you know, emailing, share photos. Just try to be really aware of the other families and their needs.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. Again, we're talking with Wendy Kramer, the founder of the Donor Sibling Registry. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Peter's with us from Timber Pines in Florida.
Yes. I recently connected with my biological daughter through Wendy's website. And so I'm calling in to share whatever information you'd like to hear from me.
Well, did any of your donor children get in touch with you?
What happened was I saw that my biological daughter had a posting on Wendy's website. I joined the website to connect with her. We have not yet met because she's far away at school. She's a college sophomore, but we plan to meet this summertime, and we are in daily communication.
And why, when you saw that posting, why did you decide to identify yourself on the website?
I always wanted to meet whatever biological children resulted from my sperm donations. I saw no reason not to. I decided that I would let my biological daughter decide how much of a relationship she wants. And we've spoken on the phone. I've spoken to her mother. We email constantly, instant message, text message, webcam. So everyone is very happy. My wife is happy. All concerned are very happy.
So this is family.
Yeah. I mean, what's amazing to me is I would not have thought just the fact that she shares my genes has given, at least on my end, a strong emotional connection to her. And it also helps that she bears a striking physical resemblance to me.
And how long after you made the sperm donation, obviously somewhat 18 years ago at least, I would think, how long after that did you think about, gee, I wonder what happened to those kids that may or may not have been born?
I always in the back of my mind wondered what would happen. The way I came to Wendy's website, I was reading an article on the Internet about people who were seeking their sperm donor fathers, and I just did some Googling and put in my serial number from when I was at the sperm bank, and I arrived at Wendy's site, and voila, I saw that my biological daughter had my serial number and physical description.
Well, Peter, we wish you and your daughter the best of luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call. If you'd like to join the conversation, if this is your story about searching out sibling donors or sibling dads, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Wendy Kramer of the Donor Sibling Registry will stay with us, and we'll take more of your calls as well. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are any number of reasons why people might decide to reach out to donor dads or to donor siblings. As we've heard, the Internet helps make that easier than ever, though the stories don't always have a happy ending. We'll hear more about that in a moment. If you're a donor or the child of a donor, have you tried to find each other? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guest is Wendy Kramer, founder of the Donor Sibling Registry website. And Wendy, I guess this is a question that would get a different answer from a lot of different people, but at what age do you tell your child that he or she is the daughter of a donor?
Well, I think that depends, because about a third of the parents on our website are heterosexual couples, and my understanding is that at this point, 90% of them don't tell their children the truth ever. And my own son, Ryan, has sort of felt the effect of that, as knowing that he's got half-siblings that don't know they're donor-conceived. So that definitely throws a wrench into it. Then the other third of the parents on our site are single moms, and the other third are lesbian moms. So those two last categories basically have to disclose, because the child realizes at a very young age that there is no dad in the household. So we are huge proponents of disclosure and honesty and a child's right to know the truth about the methodology of their conception. So we feel family secrets are toxic, and honesty is the best way to go when a kid starts asking, or even before that, so that it's always a part of who they are. For my son Ryan, when he was two, he came to me and asked, "So did my dad die or what?" And at that point, I knew, okay, here we go. We're going to start this conversation. And that was the cornerstone of the conversation that we then carried on through, you know, all of his childhood. Whenever he would inquire, we'd go a little bit deeper and a little bit wider into his understanding about why we chose donor insemination and what that meant for him, and dealing with his you know, curiosity and his frustration at times. So when people ask him, wow, what was it like when you found out you were donor conceived, he kind of laughs and says, you know, it's the same as finding out I had blonde hair. You know, it's just always been a part of who he was. And we've also done research with Cambridge University, and our research does back that up. It shows the earlier that you tell, the better off for the child. If you tell when they're older, they many times have a sense of that they were lied to, and they feel a sense of betrayal.
Let's get Jane on the line. Jane with us from Middleton, Ohio.
Yes.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. We had a donor that I had eggs transplanted in me because of me being 44 and my husband was 49. He had never had children, so we wanted children. And well, she wanted to keep in contact with us, and I just don't feel like that's right. I mean, but she didn't keep in contact with me. Him and her kept in contact with each other.
I see.
And I feel that's deceiving.
How old is the child now?
Well, I have triplets, and they are four.
And do you plan to tell them about their donor mom?
I don't know. I kind of feel like it right now, if I do, that they will use that. I mean, you know how multiples are. I don't know if you do or not, but multiples are sort of like they feed off of attention. But I kind of feel like they will take and use that by saying, you know, if they get into trouble or whatever, they say stuff like, I want my real mom.
I see.
I don't want them to think that I'm not their real mom. Maybe it's me. I don't know.
I don't know. Wendy Kramer, I assume that happens, with both sexes.
Yes, it happens in families where there's a non-biological parent. And I do understand her hesitation there. Although I do feel very strongly that it is a child's right to know the truth, I hear from too many of these donor-conceived people who find out by mistake later on. And there's a, you know, with DNA testing and the internet, and it's just too probable that your child will find out. So I think so much healthier in a family. These kids, when they're not told the truth, they sense something. Somebody says to the mom, oh, you know, she's got your eyes. And the mom looks down and the dad glances over. And kids pick up on these subtleties. The one thing that older donor-conceived people say when they find out, the number one emotion they feel is relief, because they say, I always knew something. They sensed something, that something wasn't right. And I feel in families it's so much healthier to be open and honest. And when your kids are teens, yeah, they're going to say things, whether you're, you know, the biological mom or not.
I don't have an experience with multiples, but I have experience with teenagers, and yes, they will say those things.
Well, I'm talking about like now. I mean, at the age of four, when they're disciplined, they will go to their dad.
Oh, everybody shops for the easiest parent. But Jane, look, we know this is not an easy decision, and good luck with it.
How old do you do it? I mean, how you know, when do you tell them when they can understand? Or, I mean,
yeah.
I'm willing to tell them, but I really feel uncomfortable about letting them get to know the donor.
That's another decision you're going to have to make. That's a decision. Well, you know, it all goes back to the original decision, so you have to figure it out. And fortunately, you have time to work it out.
Yeah.
Jane, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Joining us now is Liza Mundy. She's the author of Everything Conceivable, a book about assisted reproductive technologies. And Liza Mundy joins us from the studios of the Kaiser Family Foundation in Menlo Park, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And how many people are we talking about? How many Americans are born through assisted reproductive technologies?
Well, you know, the number changes every year, but certainly in total, we're now talking about... Well, IVF would be hundreds of thousands of children now. And then with donor sperm, you know, there's really no quantifying in this country of donor sperm. I wanted to say one thing in just response to that last question that you got. Also, one thing to keep in mind, if children are not told that they are donor conceived is that they will grow up thinking they are genetically related to someone they're not genetically related to. And Wendy was talking mostly about, you know, issues of identity, but also when you go for your annual physical as an adult, your doctor often asks you about the medical history of your parents. And if you think someone is your biological parent who's not your biological parent, you know, that can create a lot of complications in and of itself.
Medical concerns as well, of course. But, moving on from that, the anonymity of sperm donors, is that protected by law?
No, there are no laws really governing the question of anonymity or disclosure in this country. It's a decision that's made by the donor, the sperm or the egg donor, as to whether or not they're willing to have their identity disclosed. There's usually just a small number who are, and then the sperm bank or the egg donation agency will, you know, sometimes put them in categories of those who are willing to be known and those who aren't. But there are no laws governing this issue in this country.
So any agreement somebody may have signed with a sperm bank or an egg bank or anything like that, it's got no force in law.
That's right. And I assume that you're talking about the donor,
yeah.
An agreement that they've signed. You know, if the sperm bank or the egg donation agency did disclose the identity of a donor they had agreed not to disclose the identity of, there probably could be a lawsuit there, just, I don't know, for breach of contract. But I think also a donor would be wrong to think, even if the sperm or bank or egg donation agency doesn't disclose the identity, and generally they wouldn't if they agreed not to, but you know, there are other ways that a determined young adult could go on the internet and go on one of the DNA websites and then possibly track that person down. So you're probably okay if you're a donor who donated anonymously, but I think it would be a mistake to think that you're 100% guaranteed, you know, not to be identified.
Going to the other side of the equation, we heard Wendy Kramer's story and Susan Hollander's and a couple of callers as well. But from your experience talking to any numbers of these people, what is it that drives them to search out their relatives, people from the side of the family they've never met?
Well, I think, you know, just intense curiosity about their biological origins. The first generation of people seeking their identity were generally the children of sperm donation, heterosexual couples. For decades, sperm donation was the only quote-unquote cure for male infertility. So for decades, couples would go to a doctor and they would say, you know, the doctor would say, well, you know, we can do this little procedure and you shouldn't tell your offspring, your child, the truth. And then, as Wendy has said, at a certain point, the child may find out and I think want to uncover information about themselves and their genetic origin, their biological origin. It may be an identity issue. It may be to establish a relationship. But now, as Wendy has said, there's a generation of children, often children of lesbian couples or single mothers, you know, who sort of know the truth from the beginning. And their motivation might be a little bit different. But I think the studies have shown that it's often to learn more about themselves and not necessarily to establish, you know, a lasting relationship.
And one other question, we talked with Wendy about this, and she said almost universally, these are great meetings. When people do contact with each other, this does turn out for the most part well. Is that your experience as well?
Well, Wendy has much greater experience of that than I do. I think that it is a sense of, you know, relief and recognition on the part of the parties involved. I did interview one young woman who had searched down her biological father, and he was very glad to hear from her, but he did have to sort of negotiate the delicate situation of having a wife and children of his own who didn't know that he had been a sperm donor. So he had to sort of gradually warm them up to the idea that there was a genetic relationship in the family that they hadn't known about. So, you know, I think there is a certain amount of diplomacy sometimes involved in these meetings.
Liza Mundy of the Washington Post, also with us, Wendy Kramer, the founder of the Donor Sibling Registry. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Susan. Susan calling us from San Francisco.
Hi there. First of all, I want to thank Wendy for setting up the registry. It's been a wonderful experience for me and for my daughter. I'm a single mother of a donor-produced 12-year-old. And we have Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. We have found, let's see, four of her siblings, one brother, half-brother here in the Bay Area, one in the Boston area, and two in the Midwest. And we've met the one here and the one on the East Coast. And the moms all have a Yahoo group, and the kids have their own Yahoo group, and we're all in touch. And my daughter and I have spent a couple of nights, last couple of summers with the Boston family, and we call each other a clan. We're trying to figure out a word. But we have
clan sounds pretty good, but it's
clan. Yeah.
We hear about all these family reunions. They gather at some central point in the country. This could be unusually interesting.
Yeah, well, and we hope to all. There are two full siblings who are in Kansas City. And we haven't. The Boston family's met everybody, and we're hoping at some point to be able to all gather together. But there's another interesting aspect of the story, which is that the Boston sister turned out to be in school with two of her half brothers.
Really?
And they were discovered accidentally at a social gathering.
Oh my gosh!
And what's interesting about it is that. The moms of these boys, they weren't looking. They weren't on the registry. They weren't looking to meet siblings, and they were a little shocked by the whole experience, I guess. And they have chosen not to be part of the group.
Huh.
And so, you know, I mean, we obviously would love to, you know, bring them in and be in touch with them, and but whatever. Their concerns or motivations, I don't know, because I've never been in touch with them, but they have chosen not to participate. And obviously the Boston, and they didn't know really the details of their origin, I think. I don't think it was all really made clear to them.
Well, they may now.
Well, they do now. Yeah. And the kids, there's a younger boy and a boy who's 12, like my daughter and the sister in Boston, and they get along really well, evidently, and have a nice relationship.
Well, I'm glad this has all worked out so well, Susan.
Yeah, and there's also, but interestingly also, another family or mom, I'm not sure what, has connected on the website, on the registry, and I reached out to her, but she has not responded, which I think is also interesting. You put yourself out there and then choose not to follow through with making a contact. So. Mm-hmm. Every year, it's different for everybody, but it is a wonderful thing for the kids to be able to connect, and I think they will have a lifelong connection.
Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Alex calling from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi, Alex. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have two lesbian parents, and I just recently went looking for my donor in the last actual couple months, and I found out his name through the registry, and I got some pictures of him, but I've been really tentative on contacting him because I feel like he must have just donated sperm early on to get some money when he was young, and I don't know if he would want, you know, to find out who his children are.
That's an interesting point. Eliza Mundy, I assume Mundy, most of these donors did it for money a long time ago.
Yes, I think that's a fair assumption. I mean, people may do it for sort of, reasons of helping out others. And a lot of egg donors actually, you know, like the idea of helping people have a family who want to have a family. But money is definitely part of the equation. And I think that would have been particularly true of, you know, sperm donors now, but certainly previously. So I think this caller is making a fair assumption.
And Alex, are you going to pursue this?
I've sitting on it. I'm going to think about it. I'm not sure.
That's probably a wise thing to do.
Yeah.
Any advice for him, Wendy Kramer?
I would say, what we used to think is that what we were told was that the donors were promised anonymity and just don't go there. And what I found over the years, like I said, we've got more than 900 of them. They come to our website and they say, promised anonymity. Nobody gave us any choice. And at times, they're just as curious, you know, whether they've had kids of their own or whether they haven't. A lot of them are curious. And I think for the donor-conceived people, if they reach out to the donor, it's basically not to intrude on their life or their privacy. Nobody wants money. Nobody's looking for a dad. They just want answers to some questions. And I think it's also giving the donors an opportunity to get to know them. So this is just what I've heard from donors, that it's more than not a really positive experience for them, too.
Alex, good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Interesting conversation. Wendy Kramer, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Wendy Kramer joined us from Boulder, Colorado. She's the founder of the Donor Sibling Registry. We also need to thank Liza Mundy, who joined us from the Kaiser Family Foundation in Menlo Park, California. She's a staff writer for the Washington Post and author of the book Everything Conceivable. Liza, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we start a new series with, well, economists, people in business, people who might know the answer to the question, how bad is it going to get? We start with economist Jeffrey Sachs. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. Talk of the Nation, NPR News.